We're going to be discussing today the halachic perspective on bankruptcy. This is a particularly interesting case study in Choshen Mishpat, Jewish civil law, and halacha in general. Halacha itself has no native notion of bankruptcy, as we'll discuss. Halacha has no notion at all of bankruptcy or of any kind of statute of limitation on debts. All the discussion that we're going to be having today is essentially going to be about how halacha relates to bankruptcy law, modern law, earlier law, European law, and so on, Islamic law, Western law, as well as customs that develop among merchants and society based on the law, based on just customs, common law, so to speak. So this is going to be an important case study in how halacha deals with foreign bodies of law, foreign custom. Additionally, it presents an interesting insight into the evolution of halacha in the Talmud, in the early codes. You're not really going to find anything about bankruptcy because there is no notion of bankruptcy. We're going to discuss how halacha develops when faced with kind of facts on the ground, legal facts on the ground, customary facts on the ground. Choshen Mishpat is somewhat unique in this area, that halacha often finds itself having to deal with the realia that are generated by custom, by law. Business develops in a certain way, halacha then has to decide what to do with it. We have that in other areas of halacha too. As technology advances, halacha has to say, is driving permitted on Shabbos? Can you eat tomatoes that have turkey genes in them, and so on? But the principles, so to speak, are really the standard halachic principles that are applied to modern situations. Choshen Mishpat works a little differently. Since in civil law, there is a pretty strong freedom of contract, and there's a pretty strong general idea that society and individuals are free to order their affairs as they see fit. So halacha kind of is going to be okay very often with alternate arrangements to the ones envisioned by the classic codes. Not always, and there are all kinds of rules, and of course it's a lot more complicated than that. That's basically what we're going to be dealing with. As we'll see, our discussion will be about as different notions of bankruptcy developed in various societies, how halacha reacts to those laws. We're going to primarily be discussing how Jews should relate to other Jews in a bankruptcy situation, Jewish creditor, Jewish debtor. There are other situations we can consider too. We can consider Jewish debtors and non-Jewish creditors, vice versa. Many of those cases, the discussion will be moot. The halacha generally is that when a Jew deals with a non-Jew, he certainly has the right to deal with him using the law of the land. Typically, realistically, under this principle, most disputes between Jews and non-Jews will wind up being decided and adjudicated based on the law of the land, American law in our case, but we'll be focusing largely on Jew versus Jew situations where, again, as we've discussed previously, ideally, under halacha, when two Jews have a dispute, they really should be adjudicating their disputes in Beis Din within the framework of Torah law. However, as we've discussed previously too, Torah law will often, particularly in Choshen Mishpat and civil law context, will often take into account secular law, prevailing custom, and so on. So the question is going to be, what is the scope of this taking into account in a bankruptcy situation where someone has declared formal bankruptcy in the ways it's allowed by modern law? Will halacha recognize that? I personally have sat on Dinei Torah, on rabbinic arbitration tribunals, where this very question has come up, where creditor took someone to a din Torah, took a debtor to a din Torah and said, you owe me $10,000. The debtor says, you're right, but I declared formal bankruptcy, chapter 7, chapter 11, whatever it is. The creditor says, so what? That's not a Torah concept. You owe me the money. The debtor says, as a certain presidential candidate says, I have used the laws of my country. Only once in this particular case. So that's the question. Does halacha recognize the modern notion of bankruptcy in a dispute between two Jews? Now, the halakhic literature on this goes back about 500 years, goes back to 16th century discussions. The discussion begins among the Sephardic poskim in Turkey mostly, in Turkey and Greece, in the 16th century. Now, obviously, the system of law we're dealing with back then is something very different from modern Western bankruptcy law. Nevertheless, as we'll see, many of the underlying halakhic rationales and guiding principles will still apply today. And for the last 500 years, there has been more or less robust discussion, particularly among the Sephardic tradition, whether halacha should recognize bankruptcy and going down to the modern era, we have, you know, various discussions among both in the primary literature, the secondary literature, of what halacha should do about a bankruptcy situation. In the handouts that we've distributed, I've excerpted or reproduced two or three modern discussions. One of them is by me, an article I published several years ago, a brief summary of the literature. That's number three, the last couple of pages. One of them is by our own Rabbi Yitzchak Breidowitz. He has a classic and readable discussion of the topic. The most comprehensive modern treatment of the topic is by Professor Stephen Resnikoff, a YU graduate as well, Rabbi Professor Dr. Stephen Resnikoff, a law professor, a graduate of YU, who has published a lengthy article, which I did not excerpt here because it's some 20, 30 pages, and I couldn't find a good selection to excerpt, but just to give credit where credit's due, he's written probably the most comprehensive and systematic discussion of the topic that I've seen. So, yes, so that's a good question. So before we begin, that's actually a good place to start. Let's discuss some areas in what I'll call native halacha before taking into account secular law, that are relevant or somewhat analogous or kind of go in the same direction of bankruptcy. Discuss what halacha actually has, and then we'll discuss how the poskim dealt with modern bankruptcy law and custom. So halacha has perhaps a half dozen different notions of debt forgiveness or relief of various sorts, provisions for what to do with an insolvent debtor, which in some way have some of the properties of bankruptcy. None of them are actually that close. The first basic rule is halacha has no notion of bankruptcy in general. The starting point is debts are not discharged. Debts remain in effect forever. They aren't reorganized. They aren't discharged. They aren't, we should note, many or all of you probably know bankruptcy law better than I do, but just in general, just to begin with some of the vocabulary, modern bankruptcy law has notions both of discharge and of reorganization. Debts are discharged, meaning that after some settlement is made, they do not exist anymore. Even any remaining debt is discharged. Even if the debtor comes into a lot of money, doesn't matter, the debt is gone. Once the payments or liquidation or reorganization has been made, that's a discharge. The reorganization is a plan where the court, bankruptcy trustee, will take into account what all the debts are, how much money he has, might revise how much he has to pay. So if it's a business, it might remain a going concern. If it's a personal thing, he'll still owe some of the debts, but the payments will be lowered, the total amount owed will be lower, the debt is reorganized, and the remaining debt is discharged. Under modern law, we have four or six, you know, different types of bankruptcy. We have Chapter 7, Chapter 11, Chapter 12, Chapter 13. The U.S. Code being the U.S. Code, Chapter 12 is not one you hear very often. Chapter 12 is something like reorganization of debts for farmers with regular income. Chapter 13 is a better known one. That's non-farmers with regular income. Chapter 11 used to be for corporations, now is for individuals too. Basically, the two types of bankruptcy we run into most often, two or three, are Chapter 7, Chapter 11, Chapter 13. Chapter 7 is liquidation. You give over all your assets except certain exempt assets, a home, some clothes, and then the court takes whatever you have, trustee, divides it up among the creditors. You're done. Creditors are done. Everything's over. You start new. That's still apparently the cheapest and simplest form of bankruptcy. That's what you file if you want the simplest and so on. Chapter 11, more complicated. That's a reorganization. Costs more. It's more involved. But it's perhaps in scope, it might be more powerful. Used to be done for corporations, now for individuals. You reorganize some of the debts. Chapter 13, too, if you meet certain income, certain debt and income requirements, you reorganize the debt. So what does halacha have about all these different types of reorganizations and liquidations? As I said before, basically nothing. Native halacha says that debts are never discharged. Debts are owed indefinitely, 50 years, 100 years, your heirs, the debt, if there's any collateral, it'll pass down to your heirs, the collateral will remain. Debts are never erased. Even unsecured debts are never erased. Unsecured debts won't pass to the heirs because the heirs have no basic notion, are not responsible for debts of their of their parents and so on, but the debt itself will, I guess, terminate with the death of the person who owes it, but nothing else will erase a debt. There are, of course, exceptions to that. We know the rule of Shemitah. The biblical halacha is that every 7 years is Shemitah. We know that largely as an agricultural set of rules. Can't do certain types of work. Also, there is also, though, a biblical passage about debt forgiveness. Debts are canceled at the end of the seventh year. But that obviously is a huge bankruptcy-like halacha, which would mean debts are forgiven every 7 years, which is a pretty powerful rule. As a matter of halacha, though, for a couple of thousand years, this has been kind of moot. This has either been abrogated with the destruction of the temple or the exile back in the first temple already. Even may have existed in a rabbinic way, but with the institution of Prizbal, which was a rabbinic document that creditors signed, Shemitah became kind of more or less a dead letter for a couple of thousand years from Talmudic times, certainly more recent times. Shemitah, Sksafim, we call it the forgiveness of debts, basically was not practiced, is not really practiced today in any meaningful way. So in theory, that would be a very powerful protection for debtors. In practice, it has not been an issue for quite some time. Moreover, before these changes were made, even under biblical law, as interpreted by the Talmudic rabbinic tradition, it was pretty easy to get around. Bankruptcy is very powerful in that you can't. It's not waivable. You can't give up bankruptcy protection. Usually, it's a basic right that you have. Shemitah was you can contract around. You can simply put a clause into the contract that it has to be structured correctly. You know, you want it done professionally, but it's not difficult to insert a clause into most contracts of debt that they will survive Shemitah, they will not be terminated by Shemitah. Presumably today, sophisticated creditors would usually ask for such a clause if Shemitah was applicable. So Shemitah in principle would be a major chapter of debt forgiveness, but in practice it is a lot less powerful and is somewhat moot today. Actually, it's worth noting that there are some very different rationales offered by the classic authorities for why the Torah wanted debts forgiven during Shemitah. Some would say it's for reasons that are similar to the reasons given for modern bankruptcy protection, to give a second chance to the debtor, to stop him from being crushed under oppressive debt. Rav Yonasan Eibschitz, a leading thinker about 300 years ago, he actually argued that the purpose of Shemitah's Kesafim, of debt forgiveness, was a deliberate attempt by the Torah to hobble and cripple commerce. The Torah didn't want Jews to spend all their time amassing vast fortunes. The Torah wanted to kind of limit how much business you could do by putting such an anti-business, anti-investment rule in place. It would remind Jews that making a living is important, but ultimately our goal is to serve God, to develop ourselves spiritually, morally, religiously. And remember that making money is a means to an end and shouldn't be shouldn't be the be-all and end-all of life. There are actually some commentators who relate the debt forgiveness of Shemitah with the agricultural laws, because this is like a scholarly approach, but we actually find it offered by prominent medieval authorities. Because the Torah envisioned debts were largely agrarian, a farmer would borrow money for his seed capital, pay it back out of the harvest. Because there were no harvests in the seventh year, the farmers would have troubles, so the Torah decreed a moratorium on debt repayment. Now, more than a moratorium, you'd think it would have been enough to just say, wait 1 year. The Torah canceled the debt entirely. I'm not sure how that worked, but there were those who related it to the agrarian laws of Shemitah. But in any event, Shemitah is a powerful law, but in practice it hasn't had much significance for much practical significance for a quite some time. Someone mentioned Eved Ivri before, the idea that we just read a couple of weeks ago, Parshas Mishpatim. The Torah says that if a person steals and cannot repay the debt and cannot repay the money he stole, he gets sold against his will as an Eved Ivri, which is best translated as some kind of indentured servant, not strictly a slave. The Torah uses one word for servant and slave. That halacha is fairly limited, though. It does not apply to most debts. It only applies to theft, deliberate theft. It does not apply to someone who receives an investment and the business fails. It doesn't apply to a personal debt that someone made. It only applies to basically malicious theft, deliberate malicious theft. And again, it hasn't been practiced for a couple of thousand years, since the temple times. Again, has not played much of a role in the laws of debt and debt discharge in modern and even pre-modern times.
That's in Mishpatim, but in, I think it's in Kiseitse. But in somewhere in the Mishnah Torah, it's in Purim, it's repeated.
So there are, as you know,
that's in connection with the death.
So there are, as you note, several different passages in the biblical text that discuss Eved Ivri.
Right, but presumably that's
because the death because he can't pay his debt.
He voluntarily does that, if you would like. As far as the court's doing that.
Well, so he's voluntarily declaring bankruptcy.
That's not bankruptcy. He's raising money.
I'm so right. It is not bankruptcy, but it's something akin to bankruptcy as an alternative to...
It's just a way to raise funds. It's not a judicial procedure.
Right, but it's limited to 6 years, and if his debt exceeds, he still goes free at the end of 6 years.
He goes free, but the debt is not discharged. He still owes any remaining money. He doesn't get to wipe the slate clean. They can still send him the bill at the end of the... Right, I was going to make roughly the same points that Roy Winter made, that it is something to do with insolvent debtors. Halacha also, we should note, has no notion, certainly no intrinsic notion, no inherent, no native notion of debtor's prison. There's a famous tshuva in the Rush, Rabbeinu Asher, a leading Ashkenazic medieval authority. There was a creditor who wanted to force his debtor into, again, slavery or some kind of indentured servitude to pay off a debt which he could not pay. And the Rush was adamantly, unequivocally opposed. The Rush introduces from Rabbeinu Tam, one of the leading Tosafists, school of the Tosafists, a fundamental anti-slavery rule. Ki libnei Yisrael avadim v'lo avadim l'avadim. God says we are servants to him and not to any human. And this becomes an established halachic rule, a kind of fundamental anti-slavery position in halacha. Nobody can be sold, certainly, into slavery to pay a debt, with the exception of Eved Ivri under those very limited circumstances. More generally speaking, a man cannot even be forced, we rule, the halacha in Shulchan Aruch is, a man cannot even be forced to work to pay off a debt. This is very different from modern law. A person owes money, or even alimony, even child support, many poskim say. A person owes money. He says, sorry, I don't have any money. So the court says, well, go get a job. I don't want to get a job. I want to be independent. So the halacha is, according to many authorities, the anti-slavery rules of the Torah says the court cannot compel somebody to work. Being a wage slave is still a form of slavery. A person should feel a moral authority to do this. Some contemporary authorities say that this rule doesn't apply today. It only applies back then, where socially an employee was considered a more vulgar form of more vulgar condition, social condition. Today, where middle class is the vast majority of people are employees of some sort, maybe it's different. The fact remains that on the books in the Shulchan Aruch, there is a rule: if someone cannot support a spouse, cannot support a child, cannot pay a debt. There is a major halakhic rule, without getting into all the details, that a person cannot necessarily be forced by the beis din to work, because the Torah's anti-slavery position is so strong that unless you've stolen and you have an Eved Ivri, the court cannot compel you to work, because ki libnei Yisrael avadim, v'lo avadim l'avadim, certainly can't be thrown in jail, can't be forced to work. Additionally, we should note that these are protections for the debtor, but the debt is never discharged. If he ever comes into money, he will have to pay the debt back. Halacha has no notion of statute of limitations. 80 years later, 100 years later, the guy's still alive, you can go ask him for the debt. It doesn't even matter if you've made any mention of the debt, any attempt to collect it or not throughout the years. There is no presumption of waiver of the debt on the part of the creditor. Almost never. There are one or two very, very specific cases where there is a presumption, specifically a ksuva, the dowry settlement that a woman can ask for after divorce or after death. In certain cases, after 25 years, there's a waiver. Again, that's very much the exception that proves the rule. An ordinary debt, the right to collect it is never forfeited. Doesn't matter if you've taken any steps to renew it or record it or anything, as long as you can prove it. It might be hard to prove after 75 years if he denies it, but as long as he admits it or you can prove it, no statute of limitations. You can ask for it whenever you want.
Yes. I presume also the debtor has complete discretion over which order he pays debts.
So actually, there is a very complicated and sophisticated body of halacha that discusses the order. The technical phrase is kedima b'piron chavos. The rules of precedence are quite complicated. There are differences between whether the debt is secured or unsecured. There are questions about the order in which the debts were contracted. I'm not going to get into, I'm going to apologize, I'm not going to get into the details of that. I didn't prepare that body of halacha, but in general, my understanding is that it's not usually the debtor's discretion. There are usually formal rules. It's not the creditor's discretion either. The court has to apply certain halachas which discuss whether it's chronologically which debts were contacted first, whether you split it equally, whether proportional to the debt. There is, though, a sophisticated framework which determines how, if there aren't enough assets, how the debt should be paid.
So there's a big difference between real estate and chattel.
Real property versus personal property versus chattel, secured, like we said, secured and unsecured. The halachas are complicated, but it often will not be the debtor's discretion. There are rules that govern it, but even where those halachas are applied, that has to do with what to do with limited assets available. None of the outstanding debt will be discharged. If he ever gets more money, they'll have the right to haul him back into court and say, now pay us whatever wasn't satisfied in that first round of payments. So this is basically the halachic framework of debt forgiveness. There isn't much. On the one hand, the debtor has certain protections against being sold or forced to work or certain other things. There is one other set of protections, or Breidowitz talks about this, as you can see in the handouts. There is one other important rule that, similar to bankruptcy rules, which is just as under, let's say, Chapter 7 bankruptcy, he has to, that's called liquidation, he has to give all his assets to the court, and the court will then decide what to do with them and how to give them to the creditors. But we do reserve certain assets, a house or clothing. Certain things are going to be exempt from the bankruptcy liquidation or reorganizations in certain cases. Halacha has a very similar rule. The rule is called Misadrin Lebal Chov. When a person is hauled into court to pay debts, hauled into Beis Din, he doesn't have enough assets, we will not literally take the shirt off his back. We will allow him to reserve certain assets. But again, the key thing to understand is this is not debt forgiveness. This is not discharge. This simply means if all you have is your house and your clothes, we will not take them. But if you come into more money tomorrow, we're going to be right back at your door saying, now give us what you owe. In halacha, it's simply a temporary rule that right now we will not leave you homeless. Right now, if this is all you have, we will not take it away. Nothing is discharged. Nothing is erased. All the debt remains on the books for any time in the future in which the debtor will come into more assets. There is one last halacha we should mention for completeness sake. We're not going to get into it. Halacha has the notion of yeush. In certain cases, regarding certain types of property, if the owner of the property gives up, abandons hope of ever retrieving it, a property that you lose and you've given up hope of ever finding it or ever retrieving it, in certain cases you forfeit title to the property in question. There is some dispute about how that applies to a debt. A debt is considered property in halacha too. It's not tangible property. You can't point to a specific asset. It is property that's owned, though. A debt can be sold, transferred, inherited. So a debt is property. So there is some debate in the poskim, in halachic authorities, as to whether a debt is forfeited if the owner of the debt has given up hope on collecting it. It's a matter of some dispute. And certainly insofar as the owner of the debt, the holder of the debt, has not given up hope, that's not relevant. So basically in halacha, there is almost never going to be any, except for Shemitah, which is largely moot in this question of Yeish, there is generally going to be, in most real-world cases, no discharge of debt. The question then becomes, as we began, how does halacha deal with the modern laws and customs that have grown up over the years about bankruptcy and reorganization and liquidation? So as we said, the discussion begins in the 16th century with a couple of seminal responsa of the Marashach. The Marashach is Rabbi Shlomo HaKohen, a leading Sephardic authority in Salonika, currently Greece. Back then it would have been Turkey. Salonika was a major city of Sephardic Torah. It was a leading Sephardic city with dozens of major rabbis who have books that are still studied today. Back then, it was one of the most important Jewish cities. So Rabbi Shlomo HaKohen had a couple of responsa on bankruptcy. Now, he was not discussing the bankruptcy that we're talking about again. He was not really discussing discharge or liquidation or these types of things. What he was discussing was really a dispute between creditors, not between creditors and debtors. He was discussing a case where a guy, an insolvent debtor, had limited assets. And as we noted earlier, halacha has its own set of rules for how the assets are divided among the creditors. The custom in his time, based on secular custom, based on the non-Jewish custom, based on law, was different. That there were different rules for how the assets were to be distributed among the creditors. Some of the creditors wanted to invoke these laws, these customs, and force the other creditors to go along with it. The other creditors said, no, we want to stick to whatever the Torah law is. So the two groups of creditors had an argument, and the Marashach said that we do not follow Torah law. We follow the custom of the general society of the time. Now, in order to understand why this should be true, and this is really the seminal point of modern bankruptcy, as is noted by all the authorities who discuss bankruptcy, well, the ones on the handout, for example, there are two doctrines in halacha which would justify replacing Torah law with following secular law instead of Torah law. One is a rule which some of you may be familiar with called Dina de Malchusa Dina. Literally, the law of the king, the law of the government is the law. This is a powerful halachic principle that halacha sometimes incorporates secular law that then becomes the halachic solution to some situation, the halachic framework that governs some area of civil law. Does not apply, of course, to ritual law. The government says, don't eat kosher, don't keep Shabbos. We don't listen, but in civil law context, in many civil law contexts, there's a rule called Dina Malchus Adina that we defer, we render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. We adopt secular law as the governing body of law in certain areas, even in disputes between two Jews. The other doctrine that's relevant, as mentioned by numerous authorities, is the idea of custom. Particularly in Chashon Mishpat, again, minhag and custom is something that plays an important role throughout halacha, even in ritual law. What's kosher, what's not kosher, we often defer to custom. But in Chashon Mishpat in particular, in other areas of halacha, the custom serves mostly to help verify what the correct practice is, can add chumras, but it can't really change Torah law. In Chashon Mishpat, custom is even more powerful. In civil law, as we mentioned earlier, people, individuals, society has the right to organize its affairs as it sees fit. It's your money, can do what you want with it usually. So custom often plays a much more powerful role. Custom says, custom becomes law, custom per se. Minhag mevatel halacha, minhag can override or overrule halacha. Custom in civil law areas becomes the halacha because just as if you would contractually, explicitly stipulate, this is how I want our relations to be governed following these rules set out in our contract, even if you don't make an explicit stipulation, if there is a generally known prevailing custom, that will often take the place of an explicit contract, and even Jews will be bound by that custom. So the Marshach, Rabbi Shlomo Cohen, writing in the mid-16th century, late 16th century, he adopted this second framework. He argued that in Chashon Mishpat, there's a powerful doctrine of custom. Custom often carries the day and replaces what the native default halacha would be. Therefore, he says, all these creditors who did business with this now insolvent debtor, all their transactions are governed by custom. The custom is that in the case of an insolvent debtor with limited assets, the assets shall be divided upon whatever based on whatever rules were prevalent in that society. Therefore, halacha follows that too, and that's what we do. This position of the Marshach achieved widespread acceptance by subsequent generations, particularly among Sephardic authorities. And this became a pretty widely accepted rule that insofar as the rules for dealing with insolvent debtors were widely known and widely practiced, halacha would take them into account, would incorporate them into the halachic solution to the situation based on the rule of minhag. Now, again, the early responses were not dealing with a question of actual discharge. They were just dealing with what should the rules be for allocating the limited assets of an insolvent debtor were. Later authorities, 18th or 19th century, began to discuss the question, the extension of this type of rule to an actual discharge. If the custom is that after this reorganization takes place, after this liquidation takes place, the debt is discharged as under modern bankruptcy law, that after the conditions are met, there is no further obligation on the part of the debtor, even if he comes into more money. If that is the custom, should we apply the same rule? Should we say, if that's the custom, that's the custom? All parties entered into their arrangement knowing the custom and implicitly intending to follow it or not. Some authorities said, yeah, why not? The same rule applies. Custom is custom. Custom carries the day in financial areas. Custom says that all the parties involved have implicitly decided, to arrange their affairs in accordance with the custom, so it should apply to discharge too. Other authorities said no. Other authorities said that's a bridge too far. Discharging a debt is so alien to halacha, as we noted, there is no native, except for Shemitah, there is no native notion of discharge of debt. Therefore, such a custom is considered so antithetical to the spirit of the Torah that we simply toss it out. This was the opinion of Rav Chaim Palagi, who used pretty strong language. He said, a leading 19th century authority, Sephardic authority, he said that a custom to steal is not a custom we respect. This is theft, pure and simple, he said. The fact that a debtor can have money and decide I'm not paying back my debt because I filed a formal discharge, a formal bankruptcy discharge, that doesn't work, he says. Such a custom is not legitimate. and therefore we do not respect it. We simply dismiss such customs. So there are conflicting views on the question of whether the modern bankruptcy law, in its fullest extent, including these notions of discharging a debt entirely, should be followed by, should based on custom or not. There are many authorities who say yes, but there is also a dissenting opinion. This is something, again, obviously this has broad ramifications throughout Choshen Mishpat, throughout Jewish civil law, the idea that halachic authorities will sometimes look at a custom and say, in our view, this is so degenerate, so contrary to the values and rules of the Torah, even if it's a custom, we're not going to respect such a custom, we're simply going to dismiss it. There are other sources in halacha for this, but this, now obviously the question of deciding whether we approve of a custom or not, is this something we like or don't like, do we think this is like you'd find in Sodom or something that you'd find in a modern enlightened society, is to some extent up to the judgment of the halachic decisor involved. And naturally, you'd expect different people to come to different conclusions. Rabbi Professor Resnikoff, in his article, he tries to adopt an academic tone, but he repeatedly laments this. He says, unfortunately, he keeps saying, poskim who express their view on these questions fail to engage with the full panoply of reasons for why society has bankruptcy or not. He lists about 8 different reasons, he says, both from the academic literature, congressional record, legal writings for why, what is the justification for bankruptcy, everything from the simple idea to help the poorer debtor who's drowning under debt. It leads to more efficient allocation of credit. It promotes entrepreneurship, but people know they can get out from debt. It's good for society to have the debtor rejoin society and continue his economic productive life. It prevents the debtor from doing terrible antisocial things out of desperation because of his bankruptcy. And all these, obviously, well, these are all different theories. None of these necessarily has the weight of law. But the poskim in general who have weighed in on whether they think bankruptcy is something in the spirit of the Torah or not have not typically engaged all the numerous reasons for why society has bankruptcy or not. They've kind of simply said in passing, just dictated, we think this is chamas and gezel, theft and robbery, or we think it's a good idea. But it's worth noting that Rav Chaim Palagi, at least under whatever version of bankruptcy he was talking about back in the 19th century, wasn't not at all the same as ours, obviously. He thought that was just so antithetical to the Torah that it should not stand, even if it becomes a custom. Now, digress for a moment here. There are some authorities who say, and to some extent this goes without saying, although they say it anyway, there are some authorities who say that bankruptcy protection should never be invoked if it will create a chil Hashem, a desecration of the divine name. We know, of course, in general, we Jews are charged with promoting the honor of God and respect for God and chas v'shalom, not the reverse, not creating a chil Hashem. Even different types of actions which would be permitted under strict technical halachic law, you're not allowed to do them if they will result in a profanation of the divine name. So people talk about the New York Times test. My wife says here in Washington, it's the Washington Post test. You don't do anything which you don't want to see on the pages of the Washington Post that this is what's been going on. So halacha has the same notion. The stakes are much higher. It's not just you. It's not just your own reputation you're tarnishing as a Jew. You're tarnishing the image of God and his Torah. Obviously, we're not allowed to do anything which creates a chil Hashem. Now, certainly that applies if you're going to cheat, if you're going to break the law, if you're going to fraudulently declare bankruptcy. That goes without saying that aside from any basic halachic violations you're committing, you're creating a chil Hashem. What's a little bit less clear, which is a fascinating topic to consider, which is a little bit less clear, is assuming you are declaring a perfectly legitimate bankruptcy. You're using the laws of your country, you're proud of it, you can run for president and bull your way right through it and say that's just the way business works. But assuming that you're doing it in a situation where people will look at you as being a scoundrel. People see you have all kinds of assets and you're not paying back the creditors, and the creditors might have even fewer assets than you. You can certainly conceive of situations where invoking bankruptcy law is technically legal, but tongues will wag and tongues will say, look at these Jews, you know, look at the way they manipulate the system for their own good. So this becomes an interesting question to try to figure out when this is okay and when this is not okay. To some extent, you're allowed to live your life and do normal things, that things that are legal and moral and normal, just because some people are going to be anti-Semitic and criticize you. For on the other hand, if you really are finding loopholes and finding creative ways to manipulate the system, at some point it probably will become prohibited by Chil Hashem. Exactly where to draw the line, what kind of technical taking advantage is okay, and when does it cross the line and become something which brings a bad reputation for Jews and for God and his Torah, is an interesting question. Erring on the side of caution is probably a good idea, but obviously if a person is in trouble, it's easy for me to say that. So in any specific situation, it would be a judgment call. Somebody probably should consult a disinterested party in general, and B, a rabbi, someone who has someone who is familiar with the rules of the Torah. But certainly avoiding Chilul Hashem should be a priority. This is the question of custom we've been discussing, the idea that halacha will sometimes recognize and incorporate the customs into halacha, assuming it's not too antithetical to the laws of the Torah. The other doctrine, Din Malchus Adina, rendering unto Caesar what is Caesar's, is also a very powerful principle. It often yields similar results. This is the idea that halacha recognizes that the sovereign government has the right to legislate. Both the national government, the local government, they have the right to legislate. Laws that are passed by the legitimate sovereign government are often recognized as valid by halacha. When we say legitimate, by the way, we don't necessarily mean democratically elected. These things were discussed in the Talmud 2,000 years ago when democracy was not the order of the day, typically. The Jews were writing in Babylonia and different countries where Rome, Rome maybe had some level of democracy at some point in its history, but Babylonia, other countries, there was generally no requirement that a government be democratic to have legitimacy. Certainly, many posts can point out, when a government is democratic, there's pretty much unanimity on this point, it certainly acquires even greater legitimacy. Some posts can say that the scope of Din Malchusa and the deference we have to secular law is heightened and expanded by the fact that the government is democratic. But government in general, government per se, the laws that it passes are often considered binding on Jews. The question really is the scope of this principle, and a full discussion of Din Malchusa would take us too far afield. You can read some of the attached handouts for some of the debates. But basically, there are kind of maximalist and minimalist views of Din Malchusa. Some limit it to cases, types of laws where there's a direct government interest at stake, like establishing a currency and regulating a currency or collecting taxes. Those are two areas. In case anybody's wondering, sorry, taxation is the one area of Din Malchusa where there's virtual unanimity that it is binding under Din Malchusa Dina. Anytime where there's no government interest, they're simply trying to regulate relations between private actors, that is considerably more dispute about when two Jews are involved. Again, Jew and non-Jew is going to be bound by the secular law. But between two Jews who are willing to go to Beis Din, there is considerably more debate about whether the law that should apply is the secular law or the Torah law. There's extensive debate about this. It is a very much an unsettled area of halacha. Many poskim will come down on opposite sides of this. And obviously, this is crucial for understanding whether halacha will recognize bankruptcy law under the rubric of Din Malchus Adina or not. Some poskim say, yes, we adopt the expansive view. Anything that's for the general good of society, even if they're regulating commerce between the several states and everything that the court has extended that to mean, or state governments, can certainly do that. Anything they do for the general good of society, even if there is no direct governmental interest, is valid under Din Malchus Adina. Other authorities say no. Unless the government has a direct stake in the matter, we would not defer to secular law. We would insist on applying our own laws. This is also a matter of considerable dispute. This is really a more modern discussion. There's virtually no discussion of this as applied to bankruptcy until the 20th century. Moshe Feinstein said you would follow Din Malchus Adina, apparently. Rav Yaakov Breisch of Switzerland said you would not. And this is very much an unsettled matter. Now, various contemporary authorities have pointed out that we have two theories, two models we've been discussing for incorporating secular bankruptcy law, the model of custom, minhag, and the model of secular law, Din Malchus Adina. There are some major differences between the two. One of them has to do with expectation of the parties. The idea of custom, the idea of minhag, as we said before, minhag is largely predicated on the idea that contracting parties, even if they don't explicitly say so, are assumed to enter into their contractual relationship against the background of prevailing custom. Now, several contemporary authorities, including Rabbi Breidowitz, have pointed out that would really depend on the context. Yes, if you're doing business with certainly a public company, even if you're doing business with Jews and non-Jews in a formal professional setting, then yes, there might be a high expectation, a clear expectation that your transactions will be governed by the prevailing custom. If it's an informal personal loan between friends, between family, There might very well be a different expectation. They might feel that they're all Jews and that any dispute shall be governed under Jewish law in a beis din. It might very well depend what kind of society you're in. Some societies in which beis din is a more established institution and there's more of a consciousness of Torah law, there might be an expectation that they're going to do things under Torah law. In a society which, for better or for worse, follows secular law, lives their lives in a more secular way, might be a different expectation. So this is all relevant insofar as we're trying to incorporate secular law under the doctrine of minhag. If you believe dina malchus adina, if you apply dina malchus adina, the idea that halacha automatically incorporates secular law, we don't care what your expectations are. If the law is the law, whether you expect it or not, the law is binding. Ignorance of the law is no excuse, we know. And therefore, it wouldn't necessarily matter what the party's expectations were.
It's also relevant to Rapalaji's
Right. Rapalaji's point is that halacha frowns often on customs which are against Torah. So that kind of doctrine finds its place under, with different rules possibly, but under both doctrines of custom and in Malchus Adina. On the one hand, Rapalaji himself was talking about an idea of adopting customs, which he rejected because the custom is anti-Torah. We do find a similar litmus test used in the context of Dina Malchus Adina. The idea poskims are much more reluctant to apply Dina Malchus Adina when it's both against the letter of the halacha as well as the spirit of halacha. For example, when we discussed rent control legislation, some poskim rejected it on the grounds that they found that it's against the letter of the law. Halacha has its own rules for dealing with landlords and tenants, a well-developed body of halacha. They felt it was against the spirit of the law. They felt it was against the letter of the law. They felt there's a famous comment of the Chavetz Hasharon writing about 1920. He writes, he was very skeptical toward rent control law. He says these were post-World War I laws passed due to the dislocation and chaos and destruction of housing stock in World War I. He was very skeptical of these laws, though. And he wrote, particularly, he says, these laws are the products of the new members of parliament, he said, ha-socialistin, ha-communistin, whose entire goal, he says, is to redistribute wealth from the rich to the poor, an attitude which is contrary to that of the Torah. Fighting words, obviously, and there's a lot we can discuss about the level of socialism versus capitalism that halacha should have. But in general, poskim do have this kind of litmus test to try and figure out, based on precedent, based on their hashkafa, their outlook about what the ideal law should be, trying to decide whether to apply the law will also be based to some extent on a sense of whether the law is just in the spirit of the Torah or not. But yes, the rules will be different whether we are dealing with custom or law. Furthermore, debts that arise not out of any contractual situation, like a tort, for example, guy hits your car, and so on, there is no contract, it's just the law declares an obligation. Minhag is, so some have argued, Dr. Resnikoff has argued that there is no role for minhag in such a case. That actually is an oversimplification. There is considerable literature in Chosh and Mishpat. Minhag, custom, can play a role even in non-contractual situations. Minhag itself takes on its own power to order the affairs of Jews, even in claims that do not arise out of a contract, even in claims such as tort that arise out of some arbitrary interaction. It is more of an uphill battle. It is less clear. It is less powerful, but there is some role for minhag there too. But certainly that could be a difference. That could be a difference between the doctrines of minhag and dina malchus adina. Now, we talked about socialism a minute ago. A nice way to close might be by noting a comment of Reb Breidowitz. Reb Breidowitz is concerned that you might come away thinking, in his final paragraphs, you might come away thinking that halacha is much more hard-headed and much less friendly to debtors than modern law, as he says, not so simple actually. He says because he asserts that halacha has a much more powerful, what we would call social safety net than the law does. Yes, you can't declare bankruptcy. However, he says the society, the community has an enforceable duty to support you, to help you out if you're poor, to give you bread and water, but even to help you maintain the lifestyle to which you've become accustomed. So the way Reb Breidowitz puts it, he says, halacha doesn't give the overall, he says you have to look at halacha not reductionist in individual parts, but holistically, the system as a whole. He says, yes, the actual laws of debts and discharges are stricter and more rigid than under the law. On the other hand, the social safety net is more powerful. The way he puts it is, halacha is simply shifting the risk from the debtor himself to society, from the creditor, under American law, it's the creditor who loses, the society as a whole that has to lose, so to speak, and support the debtor. Essentially, he's arguing, he wouldn't put it in quite these words, essentially he's arguing that since halacha is a much more socialistic system, especially when you take into account the laws of tzedakah and so on, the fact that individual debts are not forgiven doesn't matter as much because halacha is not nearly as Victorian Darwinist a system as the law is. Therefore, ultimately the debtor is not worse off. He simply will have to look to different sources to survive, not simply thumb his nose at the creditor, but will have to appeal to society at large to maintain him. So in summary, halacha has no real notion of bankruptcy law or of discharge. Halacha does, according to many authorities, recognize to some extent modern law, modern prevailing custom, either under the doctrine of minhag, that halacha sometimes incorporates prevailing custom, or under the notion of Dina Malchus HaDina, that we sometimes incorporate sovereign law. Both these doctrines are fraught with problems that are not universal, especially by poskim who think that the bankruptcy laws are contrary to the spirit or even letter of the Torah. They'll be much more reluctant to apply them, but there are many authorities who do. As a matter of practical halacha, it's something of an unresolved dispute. The standard doctrine we would apply, most probably, which I applied in the situation I had, is that possession is 9/10 of the law. In halacha we say, hamotz mechaver alef haraya, the burden of proof, whether it's in a question of fact or a question of law, generally will be on the plaintiff, on the claimant. Therefore, as a matter of practical halacha, very often I think a beis din would side with the defendant, given that the matter is unclear. The meta rule for deciding the case might very well be, would often be, that the defendant is, the court will not hold the defendant liable if he has filed for bankruptcy under secular law. Now there is, some authorities say, there is still an ethical obligation to pay if he has the money, that beyond the halacha there is, according to some opinions, an ethical obligation, but that's not something the court would enforce. The court might encourage him to do that, but the court, again, if he had a lot of money, in certain cases even ethical obligations can be enforced by a court, but the basic halacha would probably be, under many circumstances, the court would decline to enforce a claim against someone who had declared bankruptcy under modern Western law.